Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN-appointed independent human rights investigators said on Monday there are grounds to believe that Libyan authorities and armed militia groups have been responsible for a wide array of war crimes and crimes against humanity in recent years. In the case of state security forces, human rights violations were committed to quash dissent and exploit vulnerable migrants with no justice in sight, according to the latest and final report from the independent fact-finding mission on Libya. It documents the widespread practice of arbitrary detention, murder, torture, rape, enslavement, and enforced disappearance in the country. In addition, the mission states for the first time that sexual slavery was committed against migrants in official detention centers and in secret prisons amid rampant impunity. Here's mission member Chaloka Bayani.
The fact-finding mission has laid out bare facts and bare findings of the gravity of the situation. The alarm bell is being heard within the Human Rights Council, clearly. But what happens after this, of course, will indicate the strength of the will of the international community and also of Libya to act.
As its mandate comes to an end next week, the mission is calling for the creation of new rights monitoring and investigation mechanisms to help the country achieve transitional justice and accountability. Leveraging digital technology and innovation has never been more urgent for developing countries, Rebecca Greenspan, Secretary General of the UN Conference on Trade and Development, UNCTAD, said on Monday. The market for cutting-edge technologies is expected to grow sevenfold to over $10 trillion in 2030, she said, which presents enormous potential for the Global South, requiring countries to move quickly. Here's Ms. Greenspan speaking at the opening of the UN's Commission on Science and Technology for Development.
We gather at a critical juncture in human history. Cascading crises and systemic shocks has left developing countries with increasing debt, stagnating growth, unlimited resources to cope. Our goals for a sustainable future are in jeopardy, as overall human progress has declined for 2 years in a row. In this situation, science, technology, and innovation are becoming not just the best path forward, but perhaps the only one.
Adding her voice to the UNCTAD chiefs, the head of the International Telecommunication Union, ITU, Doreen Bogdan-Martin, said that when it comes to harnessing the power of digital technology to rescue the Sustainable Development Goals, SDGs, failure is not an option. UN agency chiefs issued a call on Monday for global action to balance and optimize the health of people, animals, and the environment as part of what is known as the One Health Approach. The heads of the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, the UN Environment Programme, UNEP, the World Health Organization, WHO, and the UN-backed World Organization for Animal Health, WOAH, have come together in the face of multiple health emergencies from COVID-19 to Ebola, continued threats of disease spillover between animals and humans, loss of biodiversity, and climate change. In a statement, the four leaders stressed the need to prioritize One Health approaches, to invest in building workforce with cross-sectoral skills, and to prevent health threats at the source, with close attention paid to zoonotic diseases. A guide on how to best implement these approaches will be published later this year. Dominika Tomaszewska-Mortimer, UN News.
Good afternoon, listeners. I hope you're having a great day today. I'm having a great day watching the news of the general strike in Israel that has been going on for days and days. It's culminating in a union-led general strike today in Israel. This is extremely, despite Bibi Netanyahu's slight concession on dismantling the Supreme Court in that country. Also, in France, the protests are continuing on a massive scale in Paris against Macron's, despite Macron. Macron has said he is stalling raising the retirement age from 62 years to 64 years. Plus, and the news media, the U.S. mainstream news media isn't covering the other kickers. The kickers are not just the retirement age going up, but there are significant wage cuts being made in the specialized trades. For instance, the railroad unions and the transport unions, buses, subways, they have separate unions there, but they are all anticipating wage cuts for future workers. Now, this is something I think is important. I was making fun of last week about how Americans are stuck into this never-ending cycle of having two and three jobs. And then we, well, not me, but a lot of people, our vocabulary has adapted to calling it a gig economy, like we're a bunch of musicians or something playing a one-night stand at some nightclub. I mean, there's so fashionable about this whole thing of being underemployed, underpaid, and always in subservience to whatever capitalist decides to hire us. That's the gig economy. It's putting, as the common colloquial goes, lipstick on a pig when it comes to vocabulary and wage slavery in our country. So we can learn a lot from the strikers in Israel and France. Coming up is the latest headlines. Well, the latest ones I could get. I think maybe I'm wondering if these nationwide strikes in Israel, France, there's the rumblings of them occurring in Germany and Ireland and in England. All these countries are rumbling. There's rumblings. It's a ferment happening of mass demonstrations. I think Democracy Now! Missed the boat today. I'm sad to report. They didn't get it out on today, their headlines. So I'm running yesterday's headlines, running our program, so you're not missing much. Here's the headlines from March 27th. At Democracy Now!
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Israel, hundreds of thousands of people poured into the streets over the weekend as the country's political crisis reached new heights. On Sunday, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu fired Defense Minister Yoav Gallant one day after Gallant called for a halt to the government's drastic judicial overhaul, which has triggered months of mass protests and international condemnation. Gallant said the plan posed a security threat after the military warned it may have to reduce operations as a growing number of reservists said they will refuse to show up for duty in protest. Israel's largest trade union is on a general strike today. Histadrut represents over 700,000 workers across various industries, including banks, healthcare, and transportation. New York's Israeli Consul General resigned in protest Sunday. In Tel Aviv, police used water cannons against protesters late Sunday as they blocked a multi-lane highway. Fires were set in at least two major roads. Jerusalem crowds also rallied outside Netanyahu's private residence.
I'm not sure, but we have no other choice but to fight.
Meanwhile, Israeli violence towards Palestinian continues. Israeli soldiers stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque in East Jerusalem over the weekend, forcibly removing Palestinian worshippers marking the holy month of Ramadan. On Sunday, Palestinian authorities said Israeli settlers burned down a home in a town northeast of Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. President Biden declared a federal emergency after a devastating tornado killed at least 25 people in Mississippi and one in Alabama. Entire neighborhoods were flattened. Mississippi residents recounted the harrowing moment the storm hit their homes.
Going through my head. Lord, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I don't want me or the kids to die.
And ran, got in the bathroom, in the tub with my wife, and all threw pillows over us, and we could hear stuff hitting the roof, a lot of trees down.
While visiting the aftermath of the tornado, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas warned extreme weather events are increasing in gravity, in severity, and in frequency. Over 20 million people across the south and southeastern U.S. are under threat of more severe storms today. In Tunisia, the Coast Guard says it recovered the bodies of 10 migrants Sunday after their ship sank in the Mediterranean. The disaster came just hours after a human rights group said another 19 refugees from sub-Saharan Africa drowned off Tunisia's coast as they tried to cross to Italy to seek asylum. At least 67 migrants were reportedly missing. This comes as Italy's government says the number of migrants arriving at Italian ports has tripled in the first 3 months of 2023, with more than 4,000 people disembarking in southern Italy over the weekend. On Saturday, a humanitarian aid ship rescued 78 migrants aboard a sinking rubber dinghy in international waters near Malta. One day earlier, the rescue ship Geo Barents, operated by Doctors Without Borders, rescued 190 migrants, including unaccompanied minors, off the coast of Italy. Virginia Miel Gonzalez, a coordinator with the group, said a new set of rules passed by Italy's far-right government last month has severely curtailed rescue efforts in the Mediterranean.
Our main concern would be being detained, so being stopped from doing what we are doing. We are rescuing people in the Mediterranean Sea, which is something that it will still happen. The people will still use this route.
Ukraine called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council Sunday as NATO condemned Russia for its, quote, dangerous and irresponsible suggestion it could soon deploy tactical nuclear weapons to Belarus. President Vladimir Putin made the comment Saturday.
Alexander Lukashenko is right. He says, listen, we're your closest allies. Why do the Americans deploy their nuclear weapons to their allies on their territory, train the crews, pilots, how to use this type of weapon if needed? We agreed that we will do the same.
The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog, Rafael Grossi, is due to visit the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant this week amidst ongoing fears over a possible nuclear disaster. The plant has had to rely on its emergency diesel generator six times over the past year due to attacks in the region. On the battlefield, the Russian mercenary Wagner Group said it captured a metal plant in the north of Bakhmut. This comes after Ukraine said its military is still holding on to the decimated eastern city, which has been the site of some of the war's fiercest battles for months. In Afghanistan, at least six civilians were killed and several others wounded today in an explosion near the Afghan Foreign Ministry in Kabul. A police spokesperson said the blast occurred after guards shot a suicide bomber near a security checkpoint, leading to a heavily fortified street housing several government buildings. Honduras has formally cut ties with Taiwan while establishing diplomatic relations with China. In a statement issued Sunday, Honduras's foreign ministry called Taiwan an inalienable part of Chinese territory and said Beijing is the sole legitimate government there. Taiwan said it was closing its main embassy and a consulate in Honduras and is withdrawing its ambassador. The move leaves Taiwan with just 13 diplomatic partners, most of them in Central America, the Caribbean, and the South Pacific. Vice President Kamala Harris has begun a week-long tour of Africa. During her first stop in Ghana, Harris said the Biden administration is committed to increasing economic investments across Africa. Harris will also visit Tanzania and Zambia as the U.S. seeks to counter Africa's growing ties with Russia and China. The government of Chad says it's nationalized all assets and rights held by ExxonMobil. The U.S. gas giant announced last year it sold its operations in Chad and Cameroon to UK-based Savannah Energy, which said it would contest Chad's nationalization plan. The West African nation has the 10th largest oil reserves in Africa and exports 90% of its oil. In Germany, transportation is at a standstill as workers nationwide hold a 24-hour mega strike. Union leaders say pay raises are a matter of survival for workers amid soaring inflation. It's the latest mass action led by unions in Europe as people struggle with mounting food and energy costs. Here in the U.S., Educational staff in Los Angeles reached a tentative deal with the school district late Friday following a three-day strike. If approved, some 30,000 bus drivers, special education assistants, cafeteria workers, custodians, and others will receive a 30% wage increase, retroactive pay of up to $8,000, and average salaries of $33,000, up from $25,000. 35,000 L.A. public school teachers joined the picket line last week with the educational support workers. In other labor news, workers ousted the appointed president of the United Auto Workers in its first direct election by union members. Sean Fain, a three-decades-long union member, has vowed to take a tougher approach in contract negotiations. The UAW has been dogged by corruption scandals in recent years. Former President Donald Trump held his first major rally for his 2024 presidential campaign in Waco, Texas, Saturday, vowing to destroy the deep state, railing against prosecutors investigating his alleged crimes.
When they go after me, they're going after you. The only way to stop these arsonists is to rebuke and reject this evil persecution by sending us straight back to the White House to expel the communists and the Marxists and all of them in 2024.
Waco is currently marking the 30th anniversary of the federal siege of the Branch Davidians, an anti-government cult led by David Koresh, which ended in the deaths of 86 people. Waco has continued to hold symbolic value to right-wing extremists, including Timothy McVeigh, who said it inspired his deadly terror attack at a federal building in Oklahoma City exactly 2 years later in 1995. Timothy McVeigh was executed. Prior to the rally, Trump posted on his site Truth Social that filing charges against him could result in, quote, potential death and destruction. The Manhattan grand jury that could indict Trump is expected to resume its work today. Trump also posted a photo of himself holding a baseball bat next to a picture of Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg. On Friday, Trump referred to Bragg, Manhattan's first black DA, as an animal. Also on Friday, Bragg's office received a letter containing a typewritten death threat and white powder. The Texas Observer says it's shutting down and will lay off its 17-person staff after 68 years of publication. The storied magazine was the longtime home of progressive journalists, including Ronnie Duggar, Molly Ivins, and Kay Northcutt. The Observer is known for its combative style, its muckraking investigative journalism, for providing an independent voice in the face of mass media consolidation. In eastern Pennsylvania, at least 7 people are dead and 10 others hospitalized after an explosion leveled a chocolate factory in the town of West Reading. The blast destroyed one building and damaged another at the R.M. Palmer Company plant, known for producing seasonal chocolates, including Easter bunnies. Investigators have not yet determined the cause of the explosion. Philadelphia officials said Sunday tap water remains safe to drink until the end of today, following earlier warnings not to drink from the tap after a chemical processing plant released as much as 12,000 gallons of acrylic latex polymer into a tributary of the Delaware River. Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney said late Sunday no contaminants had yet been found in the city's tap water system as authorities continue to conduct tests. The Guardian is reporting a police officer fired pepper ball rounds into the closed tent of slain activist Manuel Paez Teran before shooting at them with live fire, leading to their death. The activist, who went by the name Tortuguita, was killed while defending Georgia's Willani Forest from the construction of the $90 million police training facility dubbed Cop City. The new information surrounding Tortuguita's killing was recently revealed in police incident reports and confirms Atlanta police planned and led the deadly operation of January 18th. In financial news, First Citizens Bank announced it'll purchase a large portion of the assets of the failed Silicon Valley Bank. 17 former branches of SVB will now operate as First Citizens Banks. The FDIC took over SVB earlier this month after a run on the bank caused it to collapse in the second largest bank failure in U.S. history. And House Republicans passed a bill increasing parental control in public schools, including a right to review curricula and reading lists, as well as books that are available at school libraries. The so-called parental rights have become a flashpoint for conservatives and has led to over 1,600 books being banned in school libraries and classrooms from mid-2021 to 2022. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said the Democrat-controlled Senate will not take up the bill, which he called Orwellian to the core. Fellow New York lawmaker Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez spoke out against the measure Thursday on the House floor.
Look at these books that have already been banned due to Republican measures. The Life of Rosa Parks. This apparently is too woke by the Republican Party. Song of Solomon is unacceptable to Republican politics. 40% of banned books have reported are significantly addressing and specifically addressing LGBT issues.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in the immediate wake of the September 11th, 2001 attacks, a military official told the Washington Post of the newly minted War on Terror, quote, "This is the most information-intensive war you can imagine. We're going to lie about things," close quote. If reporters don't evidence skepticism after a declaration like that, it says more about them than anyone or anything else. But U.S. elite news media did the opposite of what you would hope for from an independent press corps in a country launching an illegal and baseless invasion whose leaders had announced in advance that they would lie to support it. You can dig out the reality if you read. But if you just rely on the same news media you were looking at in 2003, take two, you were looking at in 2003, you'll be equally misled and in the same, frankly, boring ways you were before. The U.S. is good and only wants democracy. Other countries are bad, and if our reasons for invading them and replacing their leadership with people we like better and killing anyone that doesn't agree with that don't add up, well, we'll come up with different reasons later and you'll swallow those too. What passes for debate about why we must remain at some kind of war, cold, hot, corporate, stealth, acknowledged, denied, with Russia or China or whomever else is designated tomorrow, well, that has some roots worth studying in 2003. We'll talk with author, critic, and longtime friend of FAIR, Norman Solomon. That's coming up this week on Counterspin, but first, very quickly, listeners will know that Gigi Sohn withdrew her nomination to fill the crucial fifth seat at the FCC in the wake of an absurd homophobic smear campaign from the telecom industry that she would have had a say in regulating and a pathetic lack of pushback from Democrats and purported allies. As Evan Greer wrote for FAIR.org, we can be sure that lobbyists for the likes of Comcast, Verizon, and AT&T are already circulating their lists of approved candidates to fill that slot. And given what's happened, we have reason to be worried that Biden could take one of those names. This is about net neutrality, the immensely popular plan to keep internet service providers from blocking apps, throttling, or charging scammy fees. It's about the digital divide, or whether it's okay that some kids need to sit outside Taco Bell to use the Wi-Fi to go to school on Zoom. And it's about cracking down on cell phone carriers' shady data collection practices, along with much more. The stakes are very high. Greer suggests checking out battleforthenet.com to call on Biden to nominate another real public interest champion for the FCC. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. So here we are, 20 years after the U.S. war on Iraq. And to speak broadly, the popular understanding is that Iraq wasn't behind the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and that they didn't have weapons of mass destruction aimed at the U.S., weapons whose immediate threat, yes, was the vehemently argued premise for a grave assault on a sovereign country. But somehow in all of this talkity-talk, the idea of acknowledgement of wrong, forget compensation, forget apology, is nowhere in evidence. The story has been made over such that the Iraq invasion was wrong, but still okay. Iraqis were harmed, but still helped. And all the advisors and experts that got it very wrong are still somehow right. The 2003 war on Iraq is most importantly a story about imperialist violence. But it's also about the web of lies and disinformation used to advance it, and the role that nominally independent journalists played and play. Norman Solomon has been thinking and working on these issues for decades. He's been part of FAIR since the start. He's co-founder of RootsAction.org and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His most recent book is War Made Invisible: How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine, out soon from the New Press. He joins us now by phone from the Bay Area. Welcome back to Counterspin, Norman Solomon.
Thanks, Janine.
Well, there are so many places we could start, but I did want to kind of stick a fork in one thing. Talking about media today at the 20-year mark, the theme is missed signals, miscalculation, misunderstanding. It's hard to talk about what happened and media's role without recognizing that the George W. Bush administration and its advisors wanted and intended to invade Iraq before the September 11th, 2001 attacks. But that's not a contention. That's just a thing we know based on evidence, right?
Yes, Rumsfeld made a very clear statement in a memo just in the immediate aftermath of 9/11 that they were going after Iraq. It was their eyes on the prize in a grotesque sort of a way. And when we look back 20 years, I think there's a consistent thread that the media and the government excuses are basically intertwined, which sort of makes sense since the disinformation messaging after 9/11, before, during, and after the invasion of Iraq, all that was also intertwined between government and mass media. And we think of and sometimes notice the revolving door of personnel where someone is a press secretary for the president, then goes to a cable news network or vice versa. George Stephanopoulos and many others who followed him just had this career path that was basically recycling between those in government who often deceive and those in media who have a follow-up career, and they're just in a different part of the deception chain, as it turns out. And so I think it's fitting, unfortunately, that 20 years after so many of the government officials and media mavens and so-called journalists, quite often not deserving the name, that they were basically singing out of the same hymn book, and now they're sort of being exculpatory for each other and themselves at the 20th anniversary. You know, one example that I think is just so profoundly grotesque is that in the months before the invasion of Iraq, you had people who were recycling falsehoods out of government sources or government-designated anointed sources into news media like Judith Miller and Michael Gordon onto the front pages of the New York Times. Then you would have Dick Cheney, for instance, who would go on the Sunday talk shows knowing that his own office had funneled the disinformation into the New York Times, then he would say, well, don't just believe us. This is being reported by the New York Times.
Right. And, you know, a number of folks have written recently, John Schwartz at The Intercept, Derek Simon at Truthout, also Marjorie Cohn, Adam Johnson at Real News, about how these visible architects of the Iraq War in government, but also in think tanks and then also in media, they've all failed upward subsequently, haven't they? You know, even what knowing what we know, there's been, like, you know, no comeuppance, no fallout for those folks.
Well, that is something I think we could call a repetition compulsion disorder that completely gets a reward system to back it up, whereas those who step out of line, who don't conflate being pro-war with being objective, they are not going to find upward mobility in media anywhere near so smooth, and often they just hit a brick wall. You know, forget glass ceiling. They hit a brick wall above their heads. You know, we have some examples that cry out for remembering and reminding people that Phil Donahue, who had the temerity to actually have a variety of voices about the wisdom of invading Iraq in the months before in his primetime MSNBC program. We know because of a leaked memo that he was fired a few weeks before the invasion precisely because people at the top of management, MSNBC, NBC News, they were worried that, as they put it in this for a while secret memo, that the flag wavers at Fox and CNN would make MSNBC look bad because Donahue was allowing some anti-war voices onto the air. And I know from having been reporting and visiting Iraq before the invasion a few times and writing about this at the time, including for FAIR, that there was a tremendous amount of pressure going on from news media. And to the extent there was an opening for debate, say in the summer and early fall of 2002, the aperture continued to narrow. And so the more that a consensus was being promoted and forced, you might say, that a war and invasion was necessary, the less space there was. I know personally, because I was able to go to Iraq with some delegations, former senator and current member of Congress, and then with Sean Penn, and then with a UN official, I found in the late part of 2002 what was first a bit of an opening where I would be invited onto CNN or MSNBC or even Fox. By the end of the autumn, that opening had pretty much closed, and certainly by the end of the year. And the explanation I was given was that in October of 2002, when the House and Senate voted that an invasion of Iraq would be authorized, that became sort of official policy. Mm-hmm. And some of the bookers and so forth at the cable news networks would say, well, you know, now this is the U.S. government's stance, that an invasion is in the cards. It's officially authorized by the legislative branch. So there's less controversy here.
And so now we need to close up any window of debate in the public conversation because officials have decided what's going to happen. And I don't think that's maybe everybody's understanding of the way journalism works or should work.
Yeah, it's a sort of a ersatz pseudo-journalism that sets the standard for professionalism. And we, I guess, ought to face it that when people move into the journalism profession, they're out of college or whatever, what defines professional standards? It's the ambience, the content, the style, the attitude that's inherent in what people who have already made it in the profession are doing every day. And so it's sort of an imitative quality that defines what journalism, or at least what passes for journalism, is. And part of that is not really apologizing even later on. And I think this, you know, gets to what you were alluding to at the outset of our discussion, Janine, that when there's an anniversary or a look back, there's really very little impetus for candor, least of all self-assessment or self-criticism, really, from these media institutions. And so even in some of the most conspicuous, egregious cases, like the New York Times distortions and serving up just bogus stories, Washington Post as well, when they did sort of mea culpas many, many weeks later, they were sort of equivocal and they avoided really shedding harsh light on how it could be that these two purportedly most important high-quality media outlets in the United States of America basically served as conveyor belts for pro-war propaganda coming from the top of the U.S. government.
I mean, to me, the fact that when you look at the architects and the folks who are most prominent in mouthpiecing for this invasion, the fact that they are all still in high-paid and prominent positions, it underscores the fact that, you know, corporate media's debate, it has a patina of rationality and of debate, but it's really kind of just a club, right? There's just certain folks that they listen to and whose ideas they promote. And it doesn't matter if those folks are wrong or right, or if they're reliable or not, or if they're lying or ignorant, they're just on the list, you know? And then there are other people who are just not on the list, whether or not their predictions turn out to be right or whether or not they're reliable. And with Iraq, that was historians and regional specialists and human rights researchers. They're just never going to be let into the conversation, no matter how correct they were.
There really are tacit media boundaries that I think are well understood, you know, however consciously or not. And when a misassessment was later shown to be egregiously wrong with a war or peace at stake, there's later on a sense of a sort of a clean slate. Let's wipe the record clean because, well, we all make mistakes and so forth. And that goes to individuals and also to media organizations. And we like to think, well, or we might want to think, the ones that are really top quality, they will cop to their mistakes, distortions, errors, even or especially when the errors were extremely important.
Right.
And yet that's not the case. I mean, one example, which at least has to do with history, and we're told that journalism is the first draft of history. Okay, later on, there should be a better draft. Of course, one would hope that the first one was accurate, given that that is the most important while these events are unfolding. So one example that comes to mind is the New York Times reported early on in this whole 20-year span that the invasion came after Saddam Hussein had kicked out UN weapons inspectors from the country in 1998. So this was the New York Times telling all of its readers that, hey, those UN weapons inspectors were pulled out of the country several years before the invasion. They were kicked out. Saddam Hussein did not allow them to inspect anymore. And Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, made the clear and accurate point and mobilized some messaging to the New York Times that that's an interesting story, which happens to be false, and that Saddam Hussein did not kick out the UN weapons inspectors in 1998. They were withdrawn by the United Nations because the government of, under that point, President Bill Clinton had made clear it was about to bomb Iraq and what became known as Operation Desert Fox. And so it was because the U.S. government announced essentially it was about to bomb the country, that the UN thought it was prudent to save the lives, perhaps, of the UN inspectors to withdraw them. And so that was something that FAIR activists were able to get the New York Times to publish a subsequent correction. Fast forward many years to the time of the 20th anniversary that we've just gone through, and the New York Times again publishes the falsehood that Saddam Hussein kicked out the weapons inspectors from the country in 1998, which sort of reminds me of something that George Orwell wrote in 1984, you know, those who control the present control the past, those who control the past control the future. And I think that's a good cautionary note to anybody who thinks, well, this is just history, why talk about it now? Because all of this is prefigurative. It is actually reinforcing mindsets. These distortions are messaging to people subtly and not so subtly that at the end of the day, I think as you put it at the beginning of our discussion, Janine, the U.S. government can be wrong, but it's still okay. We can go into war and, okay, we made mistakes, et cetera, which is easy for us to say while other people experience it with more suffering by far than those in the U.S. But it's still the pretense, subtly or not, is it's okay because we mean well. Mm-hmm. There was a short story written 100 years ago called Editha, and there's a character in it, and this is in about 1905 when it's published, which is in the aftermath, really, of the U.S. slaughter of people in the Philippines. And there's a character who says, what a wonderful thing it is to live in a country that might be wrong, but when it's wrong, is right anyway.
And that's the water that elite news media carry. And to folks who could think smarter, you know, to a population that could handle reality and, you know, react accordingly. And I guess that's what makes me so angry, is that people pick up the paper thinking that they're being addressed as an intelligent person who's trying to make decisions about what they support and what they don't support. And it's just not what they're getting, you know? It's not what they're getting. And there are a few things that stand out to me, Norman, because I know that some of Counterspin listeners weren't born in 2003, and so they've only heard the remix, as it were. But there are things that stand out for those of us who were there, and one of them is a massive demonstration in New York with thousands of other people who were opposing an imminent invasion of Iraq, who were pulled out of their apartments, people who don't usually go out in the street, who don't usually demonstrate. But we were very aware that this was a war that was going to be called in our name specifically. You know, like, look at what happened to New York on September 11th, and it was supposed to be in our name. And as I've said many times before, the most prominent message here in New York City was our grief is not a cry for war. And the desire to not turn the horror and loss of September 11th into more horror and loss for other people. And what I remember was coming home from this massive demonstration and reading the New York Times saying, well, you know, not a lot of people showed up. It wasn't as many people as organizers thought. And so wrong that the Times had to go back and re-report the story later. And so I guess what I'm trying to just get at is that the erasing and the denigrating of anti-war voices was key in 2003, and it's key in 2023.
Well, absolutely. It's the erasure of those who are either suffering under the U.S. bombs, erasure from media coverage of substance, and let alone empathy, and also erasure, as you say, of anti-war voices in our own communities and the United States, and the tremendous quantity, really, and depth of anti-war feeling and understanding. It is infuriating. It should be infuriating. And often when I read even the best, what we're told are the best mass media outlets in the United States, it seems that there's a effort, in effect, to infantilize the readers, mm-hmm. to almost like what was in school called the weekly reader, where things were really, if not dumbed down, it's just simplified, and the lens on the world, the window on the world is so tinted red, white, and blue, we're being assumed to be either naive, gullible, or simply blindly what passes for patriotic. And the staying power of people who are in the upper reaches of editorial decision-making is really quite stunning. It's hard to think of anyone who was in a major position 20 years ago propagating and fomenting and spreading the lies to grease the path, the skids for the war on Iraq. It's hard to think of many who suffered at all from their careers. They simply did fine, the ones who did all that, just went right along, often rising into the profession upper reaches. And I think, for instance, of David Remnick, who was already the editor of the New Yorker magazine during the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq in March of 2003, and he wrote a de facto editorial calling for the invasion of Iraq. It was quite vehement, and that was a couple of months before the invasion. But even worse, under his editorial leadership, David Remnick ran a magazine, The New Yorker, that published one article after another that was absolute distortion, claiming without any evidence, and it certainly turned out to be false, asserting that Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government had ties to al-Qaeda, mm-hmm. had ties to what happened during 9/11. These were very powerful messages, and many people naively, gullibly assumed, well, it's in the New York Times, or it's in the New Yorker, or it's in the Washington Post, that these kind of stories were true or had credibility. In fact, they were disinformation of the most dangerous and ultimately destructive kind.
Well, and finally, and following from that, it's work, you know, isn't it, to resist the confusion and the cognitive dissonance that elite media enforce for a person who's just trying to inform themselves about the world. You know, the messages you get, sovereignty matters, except when we say it doesn't. Invasion is horrific, except when we do it. You know, look how they oppress their own people. That's reason enough to force regime change. Oh, but don't talk about that in the U.S., you know, you freaking commie. You know, like, forget your political stance. It just breaks your brain to try to pretend to follow elite media's what they call rationality. And it, and I guess above all, it makes you feel confused and alone. And what I want to ask you is, what do you see as the antidotes to that? Where do you see the place for folks to go who recognize how brain-breaking and how wrong this is?
I think that, and as you say, the effort is so important, because if we're simply passive and let it wash over us,
mm-mm.
that's not going to work. I think recognizing that the essence of propaganda is repetition, and that if we are immersed in this constant waterfall, this flood of corporate-driven media coverage and what passes for analysis and so forth, that we're in the deluge and that we need to, you know, swim, so to speak, in a very different direction. And that includes, of course, I don't mean this as a cliche, thinking for ourselves,
mm-hmm.
and also availing ourselves and supporting media outlets that are very much willing to swim upstream to challenge the conventional media wisdom that is so driven by, among other things, the military-industrial complex and corporate power. And so that should mean including supporting FAIR, subscribing to the newsletter Extra, going to FAIR.org, supporting Counterspin, going to outlets like Truthout and Common Dreams and Intercept and elsewhere, Democracy Now! These are very important outlets, because if we don't sustain them, we will simply be overwhelmed by the disinformation machines.
We've been speaking with longtime FAIR associate Norman Solomon of RootsAction.org and the Institute for Public Accuracy. His latest book, War Made Invisible, will be out soon from the New Press. Thank you so much, Norman Solomon, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks a lot, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, FAIR.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. We'll be right back.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the waste grounds grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it will be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder they took the land. Now everywhere the walls spring up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor folks starve. We work, we eat together, we need no source. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent to laws. Still we are free, though we are poor. You diggers all, stand up for glory, stand up now. The hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim, tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down.
Contacting John Grant live. Callers are welcome. Your callers are welcome. You can call anytime you want. John Grant live.
Legislation to defang the Supreme Court so that the legislation, if they don't like what the Supreme Court rules, the legislature can overrule it. And so both sides now are accusing the other of being authoritarian and claiming themselves are democratic. And meanwhile, you know, thousands and thousands of people have amassed in the streets in places, Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The military reservists, a lot of them are saying, you know, screw it, we're not going to serve. And, you know, the defense minister was fired. Netanyahu fired him several days ago because he was against all this nonsense that Netanyahu's doing, ultimately probably to save his sorry ass from going to jail, you know, and in effect making Israel into an authoritarian tyranny that can, you know, push the, you know, own the West Bank as a colony and part of Israel and screw the Palestinians, you know, and the same sorts of things. So it's a very volatile moment at a time that, bizarre as it sounds, Saudi Arabia and Iran, the bitter enemy of, worst bitter enemy of Israel, are now talking peace, Saudi Arabia and Iran, under a Chinese supervised sort of peacemaking effort. So, you know, Israel is about to come unglued. Netanyahu at the last minute, you know, held back and said he'll postpone it, right? In other words, he's just going to postpone it so people can clear the streets, and then he's going to push it through again. So the people in the streets, leaders said, they're not leaving. So it's a, you know, they're nose to nose, these two far right wing elements and the, you know, more moderate centrist Democrats. I mean, the Palestinians are, of course, forgotten, completely forgotten in all this. They are, as the Israelis always like to look at them, they are the losers of history, and they refuse to accept the idea that they are losers of history. And so that, you know, this is where we're at.
Well, we've got a,
and it, well, it's
I got a lot of sources, John, and we got a caller. Mm-hmm. I promised the caller we'd put him right on, but I want to throw this down. MiddleEastEye.net is a good source, listeners, if you want to check out what's going on with the Palestinians and West Gaza and you know what's going on, and it's all kinds of hot stuff coming out about how their water is so polluted, the aquifers. Yeah. That it's like the United Nations.
Oh, there's
getting
a tremendous potential water crisis over there. Yeah, they've talked about it for years. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, this is like some of the stuff that's under the news that hasn't. Now we have a caller. I haven't really screened him. I don't scream a lot.
Okay.
As you know, John. But here.
Hey, we can handle it. Whatever, you know.
Yeah, we can. Yeah, we can handle it. All right, caller.
hey guys, how you doing?
All right. 217 area code. Go ahead.
What's on your mind?
Now, when it comes to that particular stuff, when it comes to the Israel stuff, I don't know. I have a little bit of a different take when it comes to that, if you guys will oblige me.
Please, go ahead, yeah.
You know, the concept, the old Greek word, for the people that lived there were the Philistines. That's where they got the word Palestine.
Right.
And then you go back to the Philistines.
I don't know if it's true. Okay, yeah. I certainly know the Philistines. The Philistine has become a term that refers to someone who is, you know, not in the artistic frame of mind, I guess.
I thought that was a determination of people who lived on that particular piece of land. If that's different, please inform me.
Well, I don't have a dictionary handy, but to look up Philistine, it certainly is a people then, but the word has come down to mean someone who is kind of not attuned to artistic and sophisticated ideas and things like that.
Yes, sir.
My definition may not be perfect, but, you know, that's...
Yeah, my understanding was that was the old Greek language for the people,
mm-hmm.
And what we
yeah,
call Israel
I think you're right.
or Palestine today. Yeah,
it's a
the
term,
Philistines.
A proper noun with a capital P, refers to a historic people, but it's
yes,
become
sir.
A word that refers to a type of person in a realm of arts and things like that. But go ahead, I'm
yes,
sorry.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And they looked back at a bunch of stuff and they saw that mm-hmm. they were actually kind of Semitic. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm totally confused about who's Semitic and who's not. Arabs are Semitic and Jews are Semitic, so how can an Arab be anti-Semitic? I never can quite figure that out, but somehow the Jews in Israel have figured that out, that somehow if you don't like Jews, you're anti-Semitic, even if you might be an Arab and a Semite yourself, you know, so I don't, you know.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. No, I was talking about, like, culturally and linguistically.
Mm-hmm.
The Arabs are definitely different than the Semitic
oh, yeah,
people.
Oh, of course,
so.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Jews
well
are
you know the history.
From Arab,
you know the
right.
history.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yeah. They were definitely, you know, going back to Babylon. Babylon and stuff, you know, the slavery there.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. That's just interesting to me.
It is.
And then,
well, the history is amazing and very, very deep and rich. You know, so it behooves us all to, if we're going to talk about this area, to learn it more, all of us, you know, not just me.
Yes, sir.
Anyway.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
and then we had the luxury of not being born yet, but they had the Balfour Declaration
uh-huh.
that kind of granted the land. From the English Empire, the British Empire.
Yeah, well, that was awful, as we say, pardon the expression, it was awful white of the British Empire to give the Jews Palestine because the Europeans had terrorized and murdered them, you know, the Germans and Poles and all that. And, of course, after World War II, the Europeans and Americans decided, oh, we got to help these folks out, which, of course, they had been terribly, terribly, atrociously abused. So we magnanimously gave them the, you know, the country or the area known as Palestine, which had been shared throughout ancient history by all sorts of peoples, including the Jews. It wasn't only owned by the Jews, and now suddenly Netanyahu's Likud party is going off the deep end and citing it owns the whole damn place. And, you know, they obviously are the winners. There's no question about that, you know.
Yes, sir.
You know, the same way with Manifest Destiny in the United States. You know, we wiped out the Indians, and the Indians were the losers in that historical episode. And in many ways, there's a parallel with the manifest destiny of the Jews in Israel who want to own the country from, you know, the Mediterranean to the Jordan River, I guess is what they say, you know. Whereas the Palestinian folks are a little upset with that, you know.
Well, I guess this is something I would like to throw, you know, just
mm-hmm.
into the topic
mm-hmm.
of conversation that... when we
sure.
beat the Ottoman Empire in the First World War, they didn't even, they were the domineering Muslim state, and they didn't even acknowledge Palestine as being a member of their state.
Who did? Who didn't?
The Ottoman Empire.
The Turks?
Yes, sir.
Well, the Turks and the British, you know, I saw, you know, you've seen Lawrence of Arabia, you know, I mean, the Turks and the British... you know, struggled in that whole area, the Turkish Empire, before it collapsed.
Yeah, but they
yeah.
were long reigning, right? That was a long reign.
Well, the Ottoman
they
Empire,
were the
of course, it reigned yeah, a long time, yeah.
That was,
yeah.
That was the Muslim Brotherhood, wasn't it? The Ottoman Empire?
No. Come on, you're getting it all mixed up here. The Muslim Brotherhood is a group that was established in the Middle East, certainly in Egypt and places like that. But, you know, I'm sure there, the Ottoman Empire was based in Turkey. I guess you would characterize Turkey as Arabic or not. I'm not sure what ethnically you would want to call the Turks.
Yes, sir.
But,
yes, sir. Yeah, I know.
Yeah,
that's
I mean,
the question.
It's very complicated, you know. Yeah, very complicated.
Yes, sir. No, I just wanted to question that because
mm-hmm.
the Ottoman Empire was the head of the Muslim countries for a long period of time, and then we crushed them in World War One, and then now we have free range. Did we not? I'm sorry, did we not do that?
My friend, that's a pretty glib history. It seems to be of a very massive, long historical episode that, you know, people have written books, 600-page books about, you know. I mean, it's very, very complicated stuff. You know, and obviously out of World War One, the Ottoman Empire was ended. Yeah, it just couldn't sustain itself. And now, of course, Turkey under Erdogan is, as Russia is trying to do, regain their sort of imperial power in some ways. You know, so Turkey is now doing things.
The gateway to the Mediterranean.
Yeah,
from the
I've
Black
been to
sea.
Istanbul. Yeah, I know. I've been to Istanbul. I know the Bosphorus. I know that. I've traveled there. And,
yes, sir.
Yeah, you know, it's Turkey. It's a big place. It's in NATO now, for Christ's sakes. You know, Turkey is a member of NATO, and Turkey is refusing Sweden from entering NATO right at the moment. So it's all very complicated.
Yes, sir. No, I'm not. I'm not even worried about that. Yeah, I know we're playing a very dangerous game these days.
Well, we've been doing it for 100 years, and of course, it's catching up to us. And you know, we you probably can look at it that we have a lot of people in the world that you know, have a case of the ass against the United States for something or other over history, you know, and it may be realistic or it may be not, but it probably is real. And as the United States is losing ground and decline, I mean, it's inevitable the United States is in decline, and you've got these rising other empires that want to resurrect their empires, and yeah, the world is entering a period of cataclysm, I think. I think we're in trouble. I think the world is in trouble.
Yes, sir, I agree with you.
And
I
so
with
everything...
You. And I don't say that lightheartedly. That's
yeah.
a terrible
and
revelation.
And so my view is we need to stop going off half-cocked and beating our chest about, oh, how wonderful we were 100 years ago or yada, yada, yada. And we need to look at the future and look at the present and say, hey, I mean, how do we work this thing out? I mean, China, you know, they want to eat our lunch. And, you know, it's they're a pretty powerful place. They own a lot of our debt, you know, and, you know, they don't have the burden of democracy. I mean, they have this one guy, Xi, who decides everything, you know, based on, you know, his being the big boss of all those billions and billions of people. You know, he doesn't have to go through his legislature like we do. You know, and our legislature, of course, now, a little bit like the Weimar Republic, is eating itself. It's just not doing anything. And so we're trying to figure it all out in this mess that we live in.
Well,
that's my quick take.
can I throw something into the mix? Because I'm being conscripted.
You're being what?
Conscripted.
Inscripted, what does that mean?
Conscripted.
You're being conscripted?
You're being drafted?
Yes, sir.
Who's drafting?
Yes, sir.
All right. Could clarify who's drafting you, if you don't mind.
I'm being dragged into the Ukraine stuff from my Scottish family.
How's that?
Because I have fealty to the head of my clan in Scotland.
What does that have to do with Ukraine?
because they're asking me and 40 other people in my family to go over there.
Ukrainians are?
No, Scottish.
No, but I mean, which side are you going to fight on if you're going to go over there and fight?
No, I'm not. I will never fight for the Russians. No.
Okay, good. Okay. I didn't know what you're talking about. So what are you're being conscripted by your Scottish clan to participate somehow in the Ukraine war, and how would that be?
I'm going to land in Poland next week, and then we're going to walk across the border with rifles on shoulder.
Okay, from Poland.
Yes, sir.
Well, what is the point of your action? What is the? I don't quite understand.
Flesh per pound. I don't know. We have. They're wanting us to teach Ukrainians how to use rifles.
Oh, okay. Okay, I see what you're saying.
I don't really.
Are
see
you
the point
a military U.S. military veteran?
No, sir. I did go to Africa in my early 20s.
So what, you, I don't know what else to call you, you're a mercenary in Africa?
No.
I mean, how
only,
would you describe your work in Africa? I'm sorry?
I'm Christian.
Okay.
And we were
saving Christians
from Muslims. Well, you were a missionary?
That would be a fair,
no,
pardon?
Yeah. I don't know how you would say that nicely. My job in Africa was to take Christians from one village through Chad into Cameroon. I'm sorry, through Cameroon into Chad, and so they wouldn't be enslaved.
So you were protecting African Christians in the area of Chad and whatnot?
Yes, sir.
Because my wife worked for years, and I have friends, of Sudanese friends in Darfur, which is, of course, right adjacent to Chad. And, of course, terrible, terrible things happened there.
Yes, sir.
So I know people from that area. Yeah, I understand how, you know, Christian issues can be operable there. So so you were... You in your work there, you were armed. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, it's interesting. It's interesting. Yeah. So you have skills that the Ukrainians are seeking.
Yeah. I don't really know if I want to teach them.
Okay. So you have some wariness here.
I don't see the point.
Of the war or what?
Well, the war itself is not really a war. It's Russia edging further into Ukraine. Ukraine can't actually do anything about it.
Exactly.
It's not a war. Yeah,
well, okay, that's a semantic issue. I take your point. Yeah, right. Yeah. And, of course, it seems to me what Russia is doing is in this idea, as I say, these sort of thwarted, quote, empires, or the, you know, you talk about the Ottomans, you talk about the, you know, the Russian, Soviet Union, and all that as an empire. And of course, Vladimir Putin's idea that, you know, he wants to resurrect some of that. And so this, and this is my idea, not my idea, but there are people who talk about a new era of imperialism. In other words, not like the old colonialist Brits and French and yada, yada, yada. It was led to Vietnam and whatnot. But that there's a new structuring in the world, especially aligned with the rise of the Internet and all this, which discombobulates a lot of things, so that you have these former empires who aspire to, you know,
rebuild their empires. Yeah.
To have new empires and to occupy weaker nations, you know, that they can, you know, help out and exploit at the same time. You know, China's doing that throughout Africa. Honduras.
Honduras is doing in Africa.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. My bad. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I wasn't trying to interrupt you. What China is doing in Africa is they inflate and deflate their money magically. The value of their money is a myth. So So they're like, oh, we'll build bridges and roads. You know, they go into
right.
Africa. They're like, yeah, we got bridges and roads, and we'll give you cell phone service. That's adorable.
Right.
Right. The value of their money is not actually a substantial thing. And they know
well,
that.
Well, but the value of their power and their influence is a potent thing because, as I say, I mean, how many, I mean, what is it, up to like trillions that they own debt from the United States? You know, so we're strapped with China in many ways already. And, you know, just the other day, Honduras, the basket case nation in the Western Hemisphere, which, by the way, in 1984 I got deported from for a political thing. You know, the United States, of course, in 2009 overlooked a coup under the Obama administration. Just basically Obama and Hillary Clinton just let it go. Well, Honduras is now the president is the wife of the guy who was couped and thrown out at gunpoint in 2009. And I think 3 days ago, Honduras blew off Taiwan. And, you know, because the president of Taiwan is now is making a trip, I think this week, to Guatemala and to Belize in Central America. Well, Honduras decided they were going to go to mainland China. So Honduras is now playing the United States off of mainland China. And, of course, China is going to just throw all sorts of resources at poor little Honduras, who the U.S. has fucked over for 100 years or so, looked at as an absolute basket case. And so now little Honduras, which in Spanish means the ditch. I mean, this was named by a conquistador who thought it was a, pardon the expression, a shithole, is now playing China off the United States. In our backyard, you know, this is where the Monroe Doctrine was established. You know, this is why we could control the Western Hemisphere, why we focused on Cuba so much.
Do you think this is going to change anything? That we're not going to still remain dominant because China is going to...
Our dominance is the big, big, big question right now. Yes. And, you know, if you think that somehow going off and bombing people and killing people like in Iraq or invasions or even Vietnam in those old days, if you think that sort of behavior is going to bring our dominance back, I think that's not a good idea. That's a failed idea. You know, that's
yes,
only going to participate, you know, and exacerbate this decline, you know, as a, you know. And, you know, look at what Russia's doing. I mean, they're, you know, I mean, this is not good for
Russia.
They're
moving nukes into Belarus. Yeah, that's adorable.
Yeah, exactly. So in my view, my fear is that we are stumbling our way, the world, not just us, but everybody, are stumbling their way into a World War III, the same way we stumbled into World War I, where the technologies were so far ahead of our glorious military ambitions, where we, you know, where they had the, you know, the Prussians and all their uniforms and plumed helmets.
Now, when you make that comparison, I really want to disagree with you, but it's absolutely true.
Go ahead.
Yes. No, I want to disagree
How
with
you.
Disagree? I really want
you
to.
Want...
No, this is exactly the same thing. We shouldn't
okay.
be there.
Right. Well. But the point is we're there. That's the point. What do you do after you've committed to this extent? And who blinks first? And it's wasteful. Think of the waste, the goddamn waste of all of this stuff. It's just – but this isn't new. I mean, we've wasted our national treasure before. Look at George W. Bush. He's embarrassed to even come into public because of the Iraq War. I mean – I was in Iraq twice during the war, and, you know, it was a disaster. Everybody knew it was a disaster, and it happened. It just, you know, it was the stupidest thing in the world. And yet, you know, trillions and trillions of dollars were hosed out, and, you know, it empowered our worst enemy, Iran. It was a total clusterfuck. But it's real. It happened, you know, and we don't forget these things. So now, you know, where I think where the United States is at a position where it's having to fess up and look at itself as to say, wait a minute, why do we do all these things around the world? And now it's all coming, a lot of it's coming back to haunt us. And so, you know, if we don't admit, in my view, I mean, a lot of people don't want to admit this stuff that we've, you know, the United States.
We were wrong.
Yeah.
We were wrong.
Well, you got to fess up and, you know, and admit it, and then look, how are we going to sort it out and work in the future in a way that avoids some kind of World War III? And World War, you know, I have a friend who is, you know, very much a leftist, and I keep saying it's civil war, and he says, oh, no, no. He says, in his mind, again, it's semantics, civil war, or, I mean, World War III has to involve nuclear weapons. In my mind, World War III doesn't have to, it could, but doesn't have to involve nuclear weapons. What it involves is the atomization of the world under the rise of the internet and technology, which is just zooming up beyond, I mean, AI, artificial intelligence, suddenly.
You're talking about
sixth generation
warfare. It's beyond,
yeah,
fifth generation,
I,
where it's just propaganda.
Like
it's sixth generation.
About, yes. Yeah. And so, you know, if we don't realize that, you know, again, the analogy with World War One, where all this mechanized death was technology had been developed, but the European countries hadn't advanced their governing capacities and their philosophies of how to get along with other people enough to get beyond the ego glory of militarism and horse cavalries and charge of the light brigade and all this wonderful stuff, you know, with great heroes and, you know, the in Europe, the in Germany especially, where they, you know, they would have all their students dueling, and they don't want to get dueling scars on their face. And so, you know, this whole idea of the glory of warfare, you know, the great macho glory of warfare. Well, it ended up World War One. They were just slogging the mud, and you know, there's no glory in that whatsoever. It was just a stalemate, and it ended up just chewing humanity up. And my fear is an analogous situation is that we have all these glorious empires, including the United States, that wants to resurrect and be dominant again, and wonderful and powerful. Meanwhile, you know, you have the internet, which is breaking everything down, and we have what we now call stochastic violence, which means random violence. We now have a transgender woman who apparently, from what I read this morning, was upset at being a woman now and wanted to act more like a man, and armed himself up and went and shot and killed six people at an elementary school. Like, wow.
You're talking about that stuff that happened in Nashville.
Did you
see the public reaction to that? They didn't say him and he.
Right.
They topped that off.
It's confusing. Well, that's what I read this morning. Apparently, there was a gender transformation that I guess the person didn't want to be a woman or after all, and then, you know, returned to more masculine sort of behaviors and, like, shooting people with AR-15s. And very confusing, very, very confusing. Which is what I'm saying, the stochastic violence, this random violence, God knows where it's coming from. ideologically to be coming from the moon, you know, because you have a lot of very strange people who are very upset, very afraid, they're lonely, they don't know what to do, and they have a goddamn AR-15. Okay.
I'm just gonna correct you on the use of the word is stochastic.
Oh, stochastic. Oh, very good. Thank you so much. Okay. Yeah.
No problem at all. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. When
right.
it when
well,
random violence
what,
pops
we
up.
We both understand what it means, although I may have mispronounced it.
I only ask one thing. We do not walk on each other. It's audio wise, it confuses the listeners.
Okay.
I apologize.
Mike, why don't you weigh in here? This is interesting.
Oh, I'm more interested in hearing the caller. I don't know how Scotland. Does Scotland have a conscription national law on conscription? If it is on
no, my friend, it's not the state or country of Scotland. It's my family. It's my family claim.
Right. So you're using conscription in an informal, metaphoric way. Yeah.
No, my family clan is asking me to go the same way that they asked me to go to Africa when I was in my early 20s.
Wow.
And this is a religious Christian-based effort? Is it, you know, pressure?
The clans when it comes to Scotland and Ireland and Wales
mm-hmm. –
and even the English, yeah. It's not a country asking me to go anywhere,
right?
But I am still I have fealty to the leader of my clan.
Well, see, this is frankly one thing that I've talked about in my writing, is and other people have talked about it for 50 years now after World War II, is the breakdown of the nation state. You know, in the Treaty of Westphalia, 1648, after the Hundred Years' War, or the Thirty Years' War, or whatever it was, they established the idea of nation states. And that, of course, has been the basis of our history, you know, throughout both world wars and up until recently. But because of things like the internet and technology and computers, et cetera, that the nation state is continuously breaking down, so that you have a sort of, if you think loosely, a return of somewhat of feudalism, which is warlords and things. Instead of warlords, we have Jeff Bezos, and we have all these huge, you know, they're going to go to the moon, you know, and all this. So you have power centers that are corporate and money and wealth oriented. You know, you have the Murdochs and all their publishing money and all this as powers in the world. So nation states are now competing with things like ethnic groups, like Scottish clans, I suppose you could say, and things like that. I mean, I'm English. My people come from English, and I'm part Swedish as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't be bragging about that there, buddy.
Well, no, I wasn't doing it to brag. I was doing it to establish some sense of reality here. And frankly, between you and me, I don't take much feel or whatever it would be to much loyalty to my English background, you know. Do you
have a tartan?
I'm a Grant. My name is Grant. We have a Grant plaid. My people came in 1630 from Plymouth, England, in a boat. Now, I assume the Grants that were English then, they came from Scotland. I mean, it is a Scottish clan, as you say. But I don't have any identity with that.
Well,
the difference is that
I'm not really. It was the clan was never about country. It was about family.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so so that's why we carried the tradition. And so I have mm-hmm. the tartan of Clan Johnstone.
Okay.
And they ask us on occasion to go handle stuff. And we do.
Well, again, that's interesting. That is a loyalty that is, as you're making very clear, beyond the nation state and the idea of the nation state. You know, this is a loyalty that you have that is, I guess, ethnic based, you know, and clans and things like that. This is the way of the world. I think the way of the world is breaking down, fragmenting, atomizing into many, many different elements, which contributes, I think, to, as I think it's pronounced right, stochastic violence, you know, which is random. In other words, there's no meaning to it yet. We haven't established the connections yet. It's so sort of new and, you know.
That's a fair assessment.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think we see the world as a crazy place, you and I suppose, yeah.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. No, this is the nut house, you know. And they said if you want a ticket to the circus, welcome to Earth. If you want the front row seat, welcome to America.
There you go. Well, Atlantic Magazine, I just bought it at Barnes & Noble, has their cover article is on the new anarchism and the violence of the new anarchism. Again, with this stochastic violence idea sort of looming over us, and you know the absolute absurdity of this transgender person gunning down three elementary school students and three of their teachers and janitors is like, what? You know, talk about lunacy and crazy town. You know, it's. But what are you going to do? I mean, you have to...
It's the reporting on it that's the problem. Because they're like, she. Yeah, and I appreciate the fact that they didn't deny the reality when they started talking about how this broad walked in there with a rifle and with apes on those kids.
I understand your irony here, calling her a broad, but you know, that's what I'm saying. I don't think these days, I don't think we really, really understand what's going on with transgenderism.
I have a good inkling.
Is a lot of time, you know, back in the 50s, like Christine Jorgensen, you know, was a very famous transgender, who had been a British military officer, I believe, and then transgendered. And that involved surgery, some serious, let's get clinical about it here, you know, genitalia surgery. Well, nowadays, I'm not sure that's happening anymore. It's like you wake up in the morning and say,
happening. They literally signed that into law. That if you identify as a gender outside of your,
right,
then the taxpayers will pay for your surgery if you join the military. That's what Obama did.
But I think some people decide, well, I want to be a she, and they don't have the surgery. I don't know, because I tried to talk to a transgender kid at a school board meeting here, and I'm 75, and it was with all the faux pas, I asked him, well, what was your name before you transitioned? Oh, gosh, it was like I'd farted in church, you know, you're not supposed to do that. Well, look, I'm a journalist. I'm curious. And, you know, the kid had pity on me and actually did tell me. But it's like, you have to, everything is so secret. I mean, it's very private, alas. But I don't, and I think it's under a lot of scrutiny, obviously. In Florida, they're making laws down in my home state of Florida. And so, again, it's a lot of unknowns and uncertainties and what it all means. And now, you know, now we got this person who this gender is confused and unclear shooting up a school and going like, what the, you know?
Yes, sir.
Crazy town.
Yeah.
You know? Crazy town. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the chief of police in Nashville came out and said that there was no history of mental illness. Are you kidding me?
that you know, begs the question, you know, like.
No, that's
you know,
the entire
that,
thing.
That police
that's,
chief,
that's,
he had these five
two,
stars
that's
on him.
Underlines.
Like he was,
I'm just saying that it's very important to understand what he was saying in that moment. He said that there was no history of mental illness. It's like, what are you talking about, guy? Yeah, that's everything.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. It's just these are semantic issues. Mental illness, you know, like, come on. You know, if somebody
I do not want
elementary
bad
school
things
students,
to happen.
They have
I know.
Some sort of
she
mental problem.
She should have been in. She should have been in some kind of clinical psychology. She should have been talking to somebody, but she wasn't.
Well, you can't in this culture. You can't unless you're a danger, evident, self-evident danger to yourself or to others. You know, the law will not intervene.
What a silly world we live in when somebody
well,
like that can walk around. I'm just saying that yeah.
Well, what
that
do you, what
could
do you
have
hold
been...
on? What do you think about arms control, gun control here? I mean, isn't it? I just was in the Barnes
I
Noble.
Literally
I,
just,
I always check
I literally
in with
just
Ballistic
about this.
Magazine and all these things, you know.
What is a Ballistic Magazine?
John, let him answer the question, John. I'm sorry,
God, my bad. Okay.
No, I'm sorry. What is a Ballistic Magazine?
Well, there's a whole shelf of magazines. I call it gun porn. There's Ballistic, there's Recoil, there's Prepper, there's a half a dozen others. You know, and there's very, very slick 120-page magazines that come out every month with the latest. It's like centerfolds out of Playboy, but instead they have AR-15.
You're talking about actual magazines, not magazines to be loaded.
It's confusing. I can see what you mean. Right. A publication, and very, very slick. And so, I mean, it seems to me when we have so much coming unglued in America, where we have people on iPhones that can, you know, say the most horrible things about anybody, or, you know, you can, I mean, you talk about identity. I mean, you have, I mean, a 35-year-old cop can pose as a 13-year-old girl and snatch some guy for making propositions against him, her. You
and
know?
I appreciate
like,
the gentlemen who do that.
But the point is, you can con people into thinking you're anybody on the internet. You know, it's
Socratic method. The internet
Socratic
double-edged
method.
Sword. Yes.
Absolutely.
The internet is a double-edged sword. You are
going to
get information, and you're going to get lies. You have to discern. You have to separate the wheat from the chaff. That's your responsibility as an individual. And man,
that's always been our responsibility. My father always told me as a child, beware the printed word. Well, the old man didn't know about the internet. It's now, on steroids. So don't trust anything. Yeah, of course.
Yes, sir. But that's the entire game.
That's why we
need
to teach critical thinking in school. We need to teach our kids to think through this crap. You know,
it's almost like people should be homeschooling their kids and taking that home because they're not going to teach it in schools. They don't like critical thinking.
Well, why don't we teach critical thinking curriculum in school from grade 1 to grade 12? And by the time you're in grade 12, you're talking about some sophisticated philosophy of how things work. In a country that's based on marketing and advertising and capitalism, you know, marketing where what's written outside the box is much more important than what's inside the box. You're not going to get critical thinking. Well, I wasn't quite finished, but go ahead.
Most of the kids in Baltimore cannot read at their grade level. Most of the kids in Chicago can read at their grade level. Most of the kids in Los Angeles cannot read at their grade level.
Yeah, failure. That's a failure of education. Yeah.
Yes, sir. I agree with you entirely. But I blame that 60% on the school system. 40%. Why can your kid not read?
Well, absolutely. It's a failure of responsibility in education. you know, I can't even get into my school here, you know. I mean, it's like a locked camp up there. It's, you know, they're so afraid of things that, you know, there's lockdown all the time, you know. I went back to my school where I graduated in 1965 in South Florida, almost on the Keys. And I was treated like a hostile person because I was going to tell them all about how we were the South Dade Rebels and we had the Confederate flag and we played Dixie at the football games. They were horrified when, you know, they thought of, oh, my God, this guy's going to tell them what it was like in 1964, you know. It's like, anyway, I mean, it was now a huge blockhouse, and it's in the agricultural district of South Dade County where many people don't even speak English, and, you know, they're trying to manage this place of agricultural workers, and, you know, it's, again, crazy town. It doesn't add up. They're a problem, and I don't want to get hung up on my old school, but... You know,
our education system
really sucks, you know.
Yeah, no, that's something that people need to realize is that our education system has almost no responsibility to educate children. I think that's something that people need to understand all across America. They literally show up. They're a part of these unions. And they...
Right.
Yeah, they have no intention of making your kids smarter today than they were yesterday.
Well, my view is one of my favorite little books, it's like I think it's the equivalent of Mao's Little Red Book for our culture, but it's by the former...
There better be a good story with this because that's terrible.
Well, hold on, just slow down. It's by Harry Frankfurt, former director, former head of the philosophy department at Harvard University, right? He wrote this little book. You can put it in your shirt pocket, and it's called On Bullshit. And it's the first sentence is, the most salient feature of American culture is there is so much bullshit. And, you know, he tries to be humorous, of course, but he has a very serious point. And our schools, unfortunately, are dedicated to promulgating all of this bullshit. And so this is the problem we're in. As I say, you know, we have a capitalist society that's run amok so that we have billionaires that are becoming trillionaires and things, you know. It's like, it's so skewed. And then in the future with AI and robotics, et cetera, and labor issues, you're going to have millions and millions of superfluous people in America, you know, that the corporate owners don't want because they don't, you know, they don't want human laborers. They have robots now, you know, and things like that. And so what do you do with a population so significantly superfluous to the whole idea of profit and, you know, and making things?
Can I actually answer that?
Yeah, go ahead, please, yeah.
Put them in the pods and make them eat the bugs.
What's it, Soylent Green, or what are you talking about?
You watch that train movie? Yeah. No, put them in the pod.
Well, that's one solution for superlative people. We can all turn
roaches,
them into green goo and eat them.
Substance.
Okay, we're having fun here. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Interesting. It's interesting that you and I probably don't see eye to eye politically. However, we do see eye to eye on a lot of these alienation issues from the great system or whatever with a capital S, which is interesting, which is very interesting.
I went out of my way for this. We agree on the problem. You and I differ on the solution.
I think that's a fair statement. That's probably a fair statement.
yes,
but I enjoy talking with you, though. I do that. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Because, you know, I think this is the problem, and I think we're going to see some of this in the coming presidential election, where a lot of my friends, anti-war people on the far left, are going to be pressured and pushed into linking with the populist right, because the populist right is against the Ukraine war, and they want to cut the defense budget, which, of course, you know, we on the left have been trying to do for 50 years.
Where do you stand on that? Where do you stand on that? Our support for the Ukrainian defense against Russia's invasion. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think that what Russia's invasion of Ukraine is just inexcusable. It's just something that, you know,
it's literally why we made NATO to begin with.
Well, I know.
So they wouldn't
I've heard
do stuff
this
like
ad nauseum from my friends. The idea of NATO is the problem here, and but that's history. You know, history broke down. After World War II, you know, we started the Cold War. You know, I just watched the movie Patton. Of course, the argument that he may have been murdered at the end of his career after World War II because
he wanted to march right into
Moscow.
No, he was right though. After World War II ended, we should have invaded. That was a legitimate critique. Yeah, that was fair.
Well, you know, you can say that, but you know, he didn't get to do that because he got run over by a truck.
There was maybe an intoxicated, maybe non-intoxicated private driving a bigger vehicle. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, that whole thing.
Yeah, we don't know, and you know, people sometimes mysteriously die. You know, Dag Hammarskjöld, remember his plane fell out of the sky, and you know, a number of people. Whoops, you know, Michael Hastings was killed after he outed Stanley McChrystal in Rolling Stone, of course, which is a death that really intrigues me. But you know, there's all these mysteries in life. Yeah, we somehow don't have all the answers.
What a strange place to be in.
Yeah, I agree. But still, life is good. You know, life is good.
Are you having a good life? Are you enjoying yourself?
I get up in the morning. I'm working on my gardens. I love to see things grow, and you know, I grow marijuana. It's wonderful. It's God's gift to man. You know, and
hey, that's between you and Jesus. That has nothing to do with me.
Well, I don't have much to do with Jesus. I have nothing against Jesus. But whether I grow and smoke weed, it's not his problem. You know. But
that's
anyway.
Cool, man. You're out there growing stuff. That's cool, man. Yeah, no,
tomato, squash, I love it. I just love to see them poke out of the ground. This idea that life, the thing that my basic philosophy is, life wants to live. That's all it's about. You know, life wants to live.
That's a fair assessment.
We work it out. Okay.
That's a fair assessment.
What's your first name?
You can stay in touch anytime you want.
Josh, and John, nice talking with you.
It's been very interesting hearing you two talk. Very interesting. Thanks for calling in, and don't be a stranger, and avoid war. That's all I got to say. Avoid war. All right.
All right,
John
take care.
Grant. Thank you, John.
All right, guys, have a good one.
John Grant.
Hey, Mike.